Today in the studio, we have guitarist, composer, band leader, Randy Johnston. And I'm so excited that you're here, Randy. Welcome to the show.
Thank you, Keith. It's wonderful to be here in Western Michigan.
Yes. Yeah, it's great to see you again. We're going to talk about our history and what you've been doing since you were born in Detroit. And
that's right, yeah.
And where you've been. But let's start with some music. What would you like to do?
I'm going to do the title track off my new album, which is called Cherry Juice. So consequently, the song is called Cherry Juice. So here we go.
Randy Johnston, Cherry Juice. Yeah, I love it.
Thank you so much.
Man, you know, so funky and so soulful. I see why you've had the career that you've had and the folks that you've played with, I see why they've chosen you.
That's good to know, I guess. I mean, yeah, I've certainly been really lucky to play with a lot of great people and had a magnificent time and, you know, really lots of cool experiences. So.
Yeah, there's so much that we have to talk about. But before we do, you know, I mentioned it earlier, you were born in Detroit, which I've forgotten about.
Yeah.
We'd met 20 years ago in New York, and it's
been
years since we've seen each other, but I forgot you were born in Detroit. How did you get started in the music? Was it Detroit, or was it...
It was in Detroit. My father is from Richmond, Virginia, long Virginia family going back to 1680, and he worked for the C&O Railroad in the Depression. He started working when he was 15, and at the time there were no jobs in the South, so he moved to Detroit to. The railroad sent him up there so he could work, and he worked in an office, and he met my mother, And so I was born in Detroit and lived there till I was 13, which was great. I loved it. And you in those days, that was sort of like the 60s, and you could not avoid great music. You couldn't avoid it even if you tried. And I remember when the Beatles came on TV the first time on the Ed Sullivan Show. I never liked to get a haircut, and my mother took me to get a haircut, and she said, "Well, if you get the haircut, I'll let you watch these guys on TV from England who have long hair." And I watched them, and all the girls were screaming, and I was hooked. I said, "God, whatever that is, that's what I want to do." And actually, even before that, I liked to sing, and my father would take me, or I remember there were a couple of radio station remotes like WJR or something, and it would always be from a car dealership somewhere on Woodward Avenue, and he would take me around, you know, a cute little kid, and I would sing a Perry Como song or something like that on the radio. But after the Beatles, I started getting interested in playing the guitar, and then, you know, of course, Motown music was all over the place. Coming out of every business, every grocery store, every gas station, every drive-in, every sporting goods store was Smokey Robinson and the Miracles and the Supremes and all this incredibly great Detroit music. And I also loved the great Detroit rock bands like Mitch Ryder and the Detroit Wheels and the MC5, which is still my favorite rock band, and Bob Seger. I remember Bob Seger was playing in a club in Royal Oak or something, which is sort of where we lived. We lived around Royal Oak, Birmingham, the north side. And Bob Seger was with his band, the Bob Seger System, was playing there. And I was too young to get in, so I climbed up on the roof. And there was this big exhaust fan on the roof over the stage, and you could like look down in that and look down and see the tops of their heads and stuff and watch them play. So, you know, I would do stuff like that, and then records. And then when I moved to Virginia, we moved back to Virginia when I was 13, and we lived in the south side of Richmond, which is kind of a redneck, tough place. The kids would make fun of me for being a Yankee and stuff, even though I'm really a Southerner, and I was very lonely, so I just started obsessively playing the guitar, and it was sort of became my identity. So that's but I've always loved Detroit, and this is the first time I've been back in several years, but at one point I was going back a lot. And I always liked playing there. I feel certain resonance with the people in Michigan. It's a little different. Every place is a little different, you know.
Right.
Yeah.
So you mentioned the Motown and the rock and roll. When did you get into jazz, though?
I got into jazz when I was about 15 or 14. And I was really into the Allman Brothers Band. I actually recently, this is one of my proudest moments, I did a couple of gigs with what's left of the Allman Brothers Band. The only one that's really still playing is one of the drummers, J-Mo.
Yeah.
But my other friends from Connecticut play with him and his band, and they do a lot of Allman Brothers songs. And they have a regular guy, Junior Brown, who's real good, but I got to sub a couple times and play and also sing the leads on some of those songs.
Really?
Which was like, you know, really, really thrilling. But anyway, I loved the improvisation, you know, and it was bluesy. I like blues. I always like bluesy things. They would take the long solos where they would just play on one minor chord for 20 minutes, you know, and everybody was, well, you know, whatever anybody was doing in those days. So somebody told me that jazz was even more cool as far as the improvisation. And I had heard things like John Coltrane's Sonship, like really Albert Eiler, really outside stuff, which I liked, but I didn't really understand it. But then I somehow got a hold of a Charlie Parker record, and after that I was just totally hooked. That was sort of another epiphany for me. I said, God, this is wonderful. This is what I want to do the rest of my life. So,
who were some of your early jazz guitar heroes?
Well, the earliest one was Kenny Burrell, who's from Detroit, and he plays a lot of, as you all know, he plays a lot of bluesy kind of licks, you know, combining it with jazz. And then Grant Green, Barney Kessel, also my good friend Larry Coryell, who just passed away about last year, who was one of my musical idols and later on became this incredible good friend and confidant. So he was one. And then certainly when I went to school at the University of Miami, I've studied Wes Montgomery really diligently, and lots of other ones, John McLaughlin, and of course, you know, the Pat Metheny's and John Scofield's. Although I didn't really study them like I did the earlier people, but I certainly listened to them. So
did you start performing when you were in Virginia?
Yeah, I was in. Okay. I started performing there, and I was in these different rock bands first. And then
as a teenager,
okay. Yeah, we had a card where we had the name of our band, and it said it was available for dances and pool parties. I started performing there with rock bands.
Okay.
And then I went to school at the University of Miami, which was I started there in 1975, and the only choices then for music schools were Miami or Berkeley. Mm-hmm. And I remember my mom and dad and I took a drive up to Boston, and you know, there's like 10 feet of snow on the ground, and the food in the cafeteria, the Jell-O had mold growing on it, and there was one woman for every 10,000 guys, and so I just said, like, whatever the other place is, I'll take that, you know. So
it's funny.
Yeah. So I ended up there, and you know, that information that, I mean, I have people coming to me now, young people that are fantastically good and knowledgeable about all these different scales and everything. And but in those days, there was no internet or anything. So when I went there, they taught me basically everything. You know, what the Dorian mode is and the Borean mode and you know who John Coltrane was, and you know, it was like the University of Miles Davis, you know.
Yeah.
And all that really essential kind of stuff. So that was a really fantastic experience for me.
Oh, that's great. Well, let's hear some more music. I know you've got a few tunes ready.
Okay. I feel so well. No sobs, no sorrows, no sighs. This can't be love. I get no dizzy spells. My head is not in the sky. My heart does not stand still. Just hear it beat. This is too sweet to be love. This can't be love, because I feel so well. Still I love to look in your
this cannot be love. I feel so goddamn well. Sorry. No sobs, no sorrows, no sighs. This cannot be love. I get no dizzy spells. My head is not in the sky. My heart does not stand still. Just hear it beat. This is too sweet to be loved. This cannot be love. I feel so well. Still I love to look in your eyes.
Tell us about that tune. You didn't really give us an introduction for that one. Maybe you didn't need one, but tell us about that tune. Why you sing that?
I always liked that song. I heard it first, I think, from on a record I had with the Woody Herman Band. Mm-hmm. Woody Herman actually sang that song, and they had an arrangement. But actually, Warren Marsh showed me that song. I was... The saxophonist, the Lenny Tristano saxophone player, Warren Marsh, was one of the first people I played with when I came to New York. And I was in his band for about 3.5 years, his young band, when he had, it was myself and Steve Laspina on bass usually, or Ed Howard and Tim Horner on the drums usually. And there's another drummer named Earl Williams that sometimes would make it, but he had a lot of standards that he would play, and he showed me that song.
Wow.
And even though he's known for really, really intellectual, cool jazz, you know, they had these, and he showed me these Lenny Tristano lines, like bebop Lenny Tristano heads, which were incredible, and you know, I can't remember any of them now, but he would sit there and play them really slowly, and I would record them on a cassette tape recorder, and I'd go home and learn them and work them up, and then we'd play them on the gigs, you know, together. And I don't think he had a line on that one. He had a line on a bunch of other ones, Lenny, different heads on the standard songs, but he knew that song, and that was one of his songs that he liked to play. So I learned it from him.
Wow.
Yeah.
Yeah, I had read that you played with Warren Marsh, and I didn't know that. And I want to talk about all the great organ players you played with, but I do think of you as more of this soulful, bluesy, funky guitar player, and you can really swing. And And I read that you, you know, played with Warren, and like you said, he's known for this other style of jazz, and I was really intrigued by that. So I'm glad you brought that up. And Steve Lispina and Tim Horner, I mean, I know those guys.
Yeah,
you know?
Sure you do. I mean, yeah, yeah.
Wow.
Yeah.
So how did you connect with Warren then?
I don't know if I can say this on the radio. Actually, you can cut this out if it's not. Not okay, but I used to have this gig when the Blue Note in New York first opened. I had this gig playing a jam session like after the main group had played, and the jam session was just myself and a saxophone player. It was before they had a band for the jam session, and it paid $10 a night. I mean, not, you know, a piece, not for both of us.
Oh, okay. Well, that changes everything.
Oh, yeah, yeah. But the great thing about it is I got to go come and hear whoever was there for free. I could get in and sit there. And so one night I was listening to Zoot Sims and Al Cohn, and Warren was in there, and I met him, and then I started going to his gigs, and it was something about his sound and the way he played that I just decided I wanted to play with him more than anyone else I'd really heard. I don't know why. And like you said, before and since, my thing has been totally a different thing. It was, you know, I came from being like a rock and roll blues player. And then, you know, later on I played with all those the organ players and more bluesy kind of soul jazz stuff, but at the time something about it just hit me. So he invited me to come up to live in this where he lived, in this residential hotel on 86th and Broadway called Breton Hall.
Oh, yeah.
And he invited me to come up and visit him like the next week, because he heard me play and he liked my playing. So I'd heard that he was really into smoking marijuana, and so I did a couple things. The first thing I did was I transcribed the solo that he had played on Star Eyes from a record with Lee Konitz and Warren Marsh, and no piano, just the. And this is incredible solo that he played with all these, across the bar line, all these fives and sevens and different polyrhythms. I had to get like two saxophone player friends to help me figure out what it was and how to write it out. And then I got this marijuana, this red bud Colombian marijuana, and I rolled it up into a couple of really nice joints. And I took it up, and so I had prepared well. It took me about 5 days for all that stuff. And I went up to see him, and he it was a record. You know, I brought the record. It was a vinyl, so he listened to it, and he looked at the transcription, and he goes, yeah, man, yeah, Randy, good work, man. Yeah, all right, that's right, you know, and I said, well, thanks, Warren. It's a great solo, and you know, I brought you some marijuana here. And he goes, well, you know, I think that's a good idea. I've been kind of trying to quit lately. I've been trying to take it easy, but I think I'm really ready for some. I'm feeling pretty strong and healthy now, and I'm ready for some. And I said, well, you know, I don't want to make you do anything that you don't want to do to make you fall off the wagon. He goes, no, it's been a while now, and, you know, I feel like my lungs are cleaned out and I'm ready for some. And I said, oh, well, okay. How long has it been since you smoked? And he said, well, it's been about 3 days now. and I said, oh, well, 3 days, that's a kind of a long time. And he goes, yeah, man, that's the longest I've been. I've not smoked since 1947. And that was like 1982. Well. Then. So then he used to have this gig at this place called the West End Cafe, and which was up on Broadway around Columbia University, And the DJ Phil Schaap would book him in there. Mm-hmm. WKCR, Phil Schaap would book him. And he booked him for like a 10-day run. And Warren's regular guitar player was this friend of mine who had been playing with him. And Warren wanted to, you know, he gave him 3 days, and then he gave another guy who was one of his students 3 days, and he gave me 3 or 4 days to, and he was going to play with all of us and see who was the best, so it would be like a competition to see who got the gig. Mm. And my buddy was such a mensch, he was such a nice guy, that he gave me all of the tunes, the book of the tunes, even though I was in competition with him. And people ask me, oh, is there a lot of competition in New York and all? Yeah, you goddamn right there is. But it was a good kind of competition, because he gave me the tunes, and I learned all of them. You know, it was like 40 tunes. And so when I got on the gig, Warren said, yeah, man, did you learn any of those tunes? And I said, yeah, all of them. And he goes, really? And I said, call one out. And he called them, and I played them. And I guess I did something right, because I ended up getting the gig. But my friend helped me basically get the gig, take it away from him. Which, because it was just, you know, whoever the best person is supposed to get the gig, right. You know.
It was an even playing field at that point, right?
Even playing field, nice. Yeah.
Wow. And how long did you play with Warren Marsh?
About 3.5 years. Yeah. He went back to L.A. After that, and then he didn't live that much longer. He actually dropped dead of a heart attack after his solo on Out of Nowhere at Dante's.
Really?
Yeah.
At the gig. That's how he passed.
Yeah, right at the gig, which I guess is probably a good way to go. I hope that doesn't happen to me tonight. You know?
No. Oh, God. Wow. Well, I had no idea you played with him. That's a great story.
Yeah, he was the greatest pure improviser that I ever played with, you know. I mean, I played with lots of other great saxophone players. I played with, 18 years with Lou Donaldson, and I played with Phil Woods, and I played with Johnny Griffin, and I played with, lots of great young guys around New York, like your Joel Frahms and all those really incredible, and Eric Alexander and all those folks. Right. But Warren Marsh was he could, on a good night, he could really play chorus after chorus and never repeat himself of all, you know, this brilliant melodic development and these incredible rhythmic things, you know, that he would do, that you'd be playing along and you'd think the time was turned around, but then when it would come out, it would be right, you know, where it was supposed to be. So wow. He was really something special, you know.
So a little bit reminiscent of Sonny Rollins, maybe, in terms of as an improviser. And
in a different way.
Yeah, yeah.
But, yeah, in terms of really, really being an improviser, you know, and we know that jazz, you know, there is a certain amount of improvisation in it, but there's a lot of it that's kind of the same, you know. Like, we played with Lou's band, I guess I'm certainly not supposed to say this in a music school, but we played, when I was with Lou's band, we played opposite Jimmy Smith for a whole week at the Blue Note in New York. So we'd alternate sets. He'd go on first, and then we'd go on, and then he'd go on the next night first. And we'd alternate. So we each played two sets a night for 6 days in a row. And Jimmy Smith played the same set every night, both sets, the same set, same songs, same order, same solos, everything the same. And Lou would do a lot of that too, you know. So that's, you know, people would think that's cheating, but, you know, Lou would say, yeah, well, the audience, they didn't weren't here last night. They don't know the difference. It sounds new to them. You know, so his idea was to try to get his best solo, you know, and present it every time.
Right.
Instead of just like sort of trying to find something else every night. So
yeah,
which is, I think that's a valid idea too, you know.
Yeah, I mean, it's still amazing.
It's still amazing.
I mean,
yeah, it's still amazing, you know.
And so you were with Lou Donaldson for about 18 years?
18 years, yes.
Wow.
Yeah, I was with Lou 18 years.
And who was in the band with you then?
Most of the time, at first it was always Dr. Lonnie Smith on the organ. And most of the time on the drums, the regular drummer who if Lou gets a gig, where now he gets a gig very infrequently, he'll still play with him, was a guy named Fukushi Tainaka, who's really one of the best drummers I've ever played with. And Fukushi stayed with Lou, I think it's when I left, Fukushi had been with him 28 years. This guy, Danny Berger from Florida, we had. And then after Lonnie finally left, we had a few different organ players, a guy from Philly named Kyle Kohler, then Akiko Tsuruga, Japanese lady.
Yeah, she's great.
Yeah, and Pat Bianchi, who is still, you know, when I play at Smalls now in New York, if I can still get him, I'll, you know, I like, he's incredible. And so we had a few other organs, but when I was in the band, it was Fukushi and Lonnie at first.
Wow.
And so that was really amazing. I was the only one that didn't wear a hat, and I figured I needed some kind of hat, but I could never figure out what kind to get, you know, because Lou would wear this stingy brim, like 60s fedora. Lonnie, of course, would have the turban on.
Yeah.
And Fukushi would have a red New York Yankees hat.
Right.
We'd travel.
Right.
And I didn't have a hat. Hats don't really particularly look good on me. So I never knew what kind of hat to get. That was the biggest problem with the band, you know.
And he let you stay for 18 years without a hat.
He let me stay for 18 years, but it wasn't always the easiest 18 years.
Yeah.
But it was really, really great. And I learned a whole lot from him, and I learned all from all of those three, you know, a lot. So.